Jose Maria Figueres, former president of Costa Rica and CEO Concordia 21.
Buenos días, amigas y amigos. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. If you will please sit down in the back, then we'll start off with our work here this morning. This is a shorter workshop than normal. We have 1 hour, of which we've already consumed 8 minutes, and we'd like to accomplish our work here. So thank you very much. Welcome to your session entitled Local Leadership, where we will be exploring different approaches on local leadership towards helping us in the mitigation and adaptation towards climate change. My name is Jose Maria Figueres, and I have the distinct honor of being your moderator here this morning for this session. I am absolutely convinced that we're going to do three things. As a matter of fact, we are already doing three things with respect to climate change: mitigate, adapt, and suffer. And we're going to do all three. Now, the advantage we still have, and will continue to have in a short window of opportunity, is that depending on our actions and our leadership, we can choose the mix of how much we would like to mitigate, how much we will adapt, and how much we will suffer. And hopefully, if we have a lot of local action and we do our things and everybody goes out of here as an agent of change to change the world, we will do a lot of mitigation and some adaptation and very little suffering. Before I call in our discussion leaders, a great panel here this morning, to start us off, in the best of CGI traditions, let me recognize some commitments that we are going to be making. Last year, I had the distinctive pleasure of giving out some commitments. And so I took it upon myself to kind of go back, aside from the tracking that CGI does, which I think is very helpful in terms of keeping everybody on their toes. I went back to see some of the commitments that I had given out last year to see how they were doing. So this is my personal assessment of two of those, nothing to do with CGI, which is, of course, a much greater responsibility and job. But first, let me address progress made on climate change capital. Is somebody here from climate change capital? Mark, are you here? Please stand up, Mark, while I point out to what you have done. Well, Mark last year committed to raising $1 billion to put up a fund that would refurbish real estate in terms of greening real estate, higher energy efficiency, and lower carbon emission. Today, Mark has already pulled a team together, a specialized team that is doing this, and in spite of the economic situation we're living in, he's already raised $200 million towards that $1 billion mark. Thanks a lot, Mark. Congratulations. A second and last one that I checked up on, OVG Real Estate from the Netherlands. Do we have somebody here? Is Marlon here? Marlon, thank you. OVG Real Estate last year committed to invest $1 billion in sustainable real estate during the next 5 years in the Netherlands. To date, 1 year after their commitment, they have invested $800 million, almost completed their benchmark of last year. And by doing that, they have really changed the face of the real estate market in the Netherlands. Marlon, thank you very much. Now let me go on to three new commitments, which we'll be tracking up on during the year. So first, let me call on stage Kim Samuel Johnson, the president of the Samuel Family Foundation. Now, this is a very special opportunity for me because I happen to know Kim for many, many years. We met in the World Economic Forum. She was one of our global leaders for tomorrow. And at that point in time, we were revamping the global competitiveness report that the forum puts out every year. So we started to think about how do we attach to that an element of sustainability. After all, competitiveness needs to anchor in our environmental elements as well. And Kim came forward, and with her foundation, she financed the first ever Global Sustainability Environmental Index, which the forum then continued to do and has become a very important part of the portfolio of the reports with respect to competitiveness. So now Kim is moving on to new endeavors, and her commitment this year, together with friends at Yale University, at the China Academy for Environmental Planning, at the Chinese Academy of Sciences, and the China Central Party School, is to fund a China Environmental Performance Index that will rank the provinces within China in terms of what they are doing with respect to the environment, and in that respect will become a very potent tool to move the environmental agenda and favor 1.3 billion Chinese. Kim, thank you so much. Now let me call on stage John Williams of HDR Engineering. John has made a commitment to create a sustainable return on investment public decision tool. Together with Columbia University, the School of International and Public Affairs. It's a long name for what he's going to be doing, but basically what they're going to be coming up with is a tool that can help policymakers and political decision makers show to their constituencies the benefits of moving forward on decisions that imply sustainability elements. I think it's a very, very important tool, certainly one that the world needs. When I was looking at this commitment, I was reflecting on the fact that where was John when I was in government and I had to explain all of these sustainability issues that cost a tremendous amount of political capital because they are sometimes hard in the short term, even though they have long-term results. And as such, I think that this will be a great instrument for decision makers. Thank you very much, John. Now let me call a team of friends from Brazil for what is a Brazil mega commitment. Everything in Brazil is mega. So this is a Brazilian mega commitment over 5 years, $268 million. If I can please have José Roberto Marinho, the president of the Roberto Marinho Foundation, and Jorge Pinheiro, Senator Tiago Viana of the Brazilian Senate, Rodrigo Baggio, Roberto Smeraldi, the Director of Friends of Earth Brazil, Sergio Amoroso, the President of ORSA, and Caetano Scanavino, the Coordinator of Health and Happiness Project. Now, this mega project brings 9 different separate commitments all around the Amazon basin. So some of these commitments have to do with incorporating education possibilities. Some of them have to do with creating new business models for the people that live in the Amazonas. Some of these projects have to do with just the conservation and the preservation of the Amazon as we know it today. The program is to be conducted over 5 years, and it will allow the people living in the Amazon basin to create sustainable livelihoods and thus help us preserve the Amazon basin. Gentlemen, muito obrigado. Gracias.
We'll have a little samba dance after this.
Very well. So now let me call on Julia Marton-Lefebvre, the Director General of IUCN, for a progress report. I've had the privilege of working with Julia. The most recent time we have worked together was in the LEED Foundation, Leadership in Environment and Development, training mid-career professionals from around the world on the issues of sustainability. Julia runs a tight ship.
Huge ship, indeed. Okay, I'm going to make you a quick summary of where we are on last year's commitment. First of all, as you may remember, we committed to do a very green building in our global headquarters outside of Geneva. And the idea is, of course, that all our offices and all of you will replicate this. So the project design has been finalized by the architects AGPS with inputs from the IUCN and the Swiss authorities. It's not all that simple. Now, the groundbreaking took place on the 16th of June. LEED advisors have told us that IUCN would be able to get a LEED Platinum certificate, which is really unique on the continent of Europe. And although some of you may not know about this, there is also another even tighter system called Minergie Eco, which is the highest Swiss energy efficiency standard, and that we're also going to get. So it's going to be a double standard building. We expect to move in at the end of 2009, and we invite you all to come there. We're working closely with all the levels of the Swiss government. That, too, is not so easy, but I run a tight ship, as you said. And we've gotten already commitments from Holcim, from Chinarps, from in Sweden, and other supporters. I just want to tell you a little bit about this year's initiative that we're committing to, because it is linked to this. In order to run this huge tight ship that is the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, we need a strong secretariat with a green flagship building. And we, from this secretariat, we run some global programs, including this year's commitment, which is the Water and Nature Initiative. The first phase has been very successful, improving water security for the poor in 12 river basins in 25 countries worldwide. We demonstrated how water management, which is done sustainably, is a platform for building safe water supplies, improved food security, opportunities for enterprise and equitable development. Now, with the Water and Nature Initiative at its halfway point, we're about to launch a very, very ambitious second phase. Generous funding has been received from the government of the Netherlands at $45 million. And what we're trying to do now is we're committing to increase this to $120 million by 2016. But the most important thing here is that we will aim to bring benefits of sustainable water management to at least 25 million people in 75 river basins. All of these things, the Sustainable Water and Nature Initiative, green buildings, and many others will be discussed starting on the 5th of October at our World Conservation Congress in Barcelona. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Julia.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Julia. Now, if I may, I would like to call on our panelists and then move into our session. So please welcome on stage Mayor Bertrand Delanoë of the City of Paris. Robert Kennedy, Chairman of the Waterkeeper Alliance. Sherry Liao, President of the Global Village of Beijing. And Mayor Bill White of the City of Houston, sir. Just a couple of admins, if I may. As we heard from Caroline this morning, Mayor Delanoë will be addressing us in French. And you have headsets on your tables because we will have a simultaneous translation. Also, during the session and while we hear our discussion leaders, you may want to formulate a question on something that they have said. So if you are so kind as to write down this question or share it with the table rapporteurs that we have on every table, those questions will be passed on to us. And if you please be so kind when asking a question, which usually has a question mark at the end versus a statement, to also, quite frankly, tell us who you would like the question to be answered by on the panel. Amigas y amigos, last February I led the scientific expedition up to the Arctic Circle. It was funded by the National Projects Holding Company of Kuwait. It included five representatives of civil society from the Arab world in terms of getting grassroots movements started with respect to the effects of climate change. And Mozad Al-Saleh, who is the CEO of that company, is here with us this morning. Minus 57 degrees centigrade was no stopper to see the effects of climate change in the Arctic Circle. But minus 57 degrees centigrade reminded me very vividly of some of my coldest days in politics, which were even colder. 15 years ago, we passed in Costa Rica a carbon tax with that name, carbon tax, by putting a tax of 15% on gasoline that then was transferred directly, not through the national accounting system because the Minister of Finance would use it for something else, into an environmental fund that then was used to purchase environmental services from Costa Ricans around the country. So small farmers that were going out of rice production because we were eliminating subsidies, and there's nothing more pervasive for sustainable development than subsidies, could then begin to plant trees, and we would purchase their carbon future crop through the proceeds of this fund. Sounds very nice, very sensible, something to do, but in terms of political cost, we dropped something like 25 points on the polls. I venture to say that we were only able to do that because, thank God, the Costa Rican Constitution allows no re-election. And so you don't have to worry about being re-elected. You can take the long-term view. But nevertheless, we have two political actors here on stage, and I want to come to them on some of these issues of transformation, which have a heavy political price to be paid up front in the very beginning, and which is, quite frankly, one of the reasons why I feel we don't move as fast on the environmental agenda as we do. Now, local action has a great part in this in two ways. First of all, to support political actors as they move forward in this decision-making process, and secondly, to canvass support and broadening understanding with respect to what has to do in terms of sustainability. Major Delanoe, let me start with you, please, sir. You were first elected mayor in 2001. You have successfully led the second French Revolution in terms of transportation and urban design in the city of Paris, which is no easy feat considering it is 105 square kilometer city. And in spite of leading that revolution, you were re-elected in 2008. So tell us about your transformation of the transportation sector and about your urban planning and how you canvassed support at the local level to be able to do this. All in about 6 minutes, please.
Monsieur le Président, merci.
Dear friends, I'm very happy to come and participate in this exchange because the city of Paris have got great ambitions for sustainable with the development with the help of the Clinton Foundation. If we've made deep changes for, when it comes to fighting against pollution, it's because at the end of the 90s, all the studies made on the health of Parisians showed that there were early deaths, children that were threatened by diseases linked to pollution. So we had to change that. And secondly, Paris, like many cities in the world, had been adapted at first at the beginning of the 20th century, in the second half of the 19th century, converted to the use of the automobile. So all that involved with individual industries that were very polluting. So we had to break out of that logic for reasons of health, even within a town, for freedom of movement. And we had to do something that was useful for and interesting for the users. Give them better ways and non-polluting and diversified ways of transportation, both on surface, which are faster, should be faster, underground, which operate better, and tram car, bus lanes, which are very unpopular, I can tell you that. But we've held tight, and if at the beginning of these transformations I was personally very unpopular, the Parisians, men and women, realized that by adding all these means, including the bicycles in freely available, and there's only a bit of on the Seine at the moment, there's a boat system, but within 2 years I hope to have a new service with electric cars, which will be freely available. The citizen will therefore have the choice. He can take a boat, he can take his bicycle, he can take a car, clean, he can take the subway, and that is the ambition that we had, because we really have to think about the city in a modern way and preserve freedom of movement and at the same time fight against pollution. Now, perhaps we'll go over this again. It's a much broader ambition. It's an economic and cultural ambition, which requires changes even in the setup in the city. 10% of the city of Paris is being transformed. We really create eco neighborhoods. We realize it is economically to be intelligent, to be smart, to be believe in these new energies. When we are ready to say to photovoltaic cells, it's less dependent on fossil fuel. It's really to be in the 20th century. It's a cultural as well as an ecological technology, which can bring wealth and jobs. I have a lot of things to say. I haven't looked at my watch, sir. Did I remain within the time that was given to me?
Thank you so much, Mayor. Thank you so much, Mayor de la Noé. I'm sure we can come back to you with some questions from our participants. Mayor White, well, you have led similar important efforts. Houston today has perhaps what is the most proactive building codes and policies with respect to the environment. And we really want to thank you, sir, for being here today. We all know what Houston has gone through, and you have our sympathy and, of course, our solidarity. We're sure you'll come out of it with flying colors. We already saw you do that when you helped the victims of Katrina and Rita before. I just want to add that Mayor White, when in a previous reincarnation, he was Deputy Secretary of Energy, did a tremendous amount for the environment here in the United States, but also in terms of getting partners and working together with other nations in terms of pushing forward environmental standards. And we in Costa Rica were very fortunate to be able to work with him directly and put together and sign the first ever joint implementation agreement between two nations under the Kyoto Protocol. Now, Houston is known for its building standards. Tell us how you have gone about that, please, how you have been able to go over and climb over the obstacles that no doubt you had in that, and if you could also please refer to the inherent tensions between the short-term political making process and the longer-term objectives that we need to move in the direction of sustainability.
Well, thank you, Jose. And, you know, in this day and time, I think that a lot of people in senior political positions may overstate the impediments that exist to bold action. We have been extremely aggressive in reducing energy consumption, both our households, our businesses. The city of Houston is the fastest growing city in the United States over the last 5 years, which I happen to follow since I've been mayor during that time. Our job growth is up by 15%, population up by 10%. But we as a city, as the entity of a city, we've cut the volume of power we consume by 6%. And so we, one of our goals has been to de-link economic growth and energy consumption so that there's not a trade-off between economic opportunity and being good stewards. People understand that. I thought that some of these things would be more controversial, frankly, than they have been. There are some vested interests, but on the general public, and I'm saying this not about me, it's about some of these policies, but, you know, my margin the last two elections has averaged 89%, which, as, you know, because people understand. Now, how do we frame this issue and what do we do? And then I'll talk about the grassroots. Hey, is there anybody you know who likes to pay more for fuel? Anybody you know who likes to pay more for their utility bill? I don't. I don't care whether they're left-wing, right-wing, or, you know, don't care for politics at all, never vote. If we reduce the amount that we consume in energy without compromising the functionality of our products, our houses, our comfort, the safety of our driving, then that's a good thing. And we can do that. And we can show how that we can do that. You know, almost 80% of the building permits in Houston are now are seeking LEED certification for the, you know, Class A buildings. And we have more commercial office building permits than anybody. But then let me change just a second, Senor Presidente, to talk about grassroots effort and what this means in all of this. You know, right now, as I speak, some 15% of the citizens of the fourth largest city of the United States have been without electrical power for 2 weeks. The property damage caused by Hurricane Ike will exceed that caused by Katrina, even though we're not in the news every day. I think there's something happening in the financial markets. Is anybody aware of that? And we didn't have people, because we were effective in what we did, we didn't have people rescued from rooftops, so there wasn't the dramatic CNN scenes. But it's been devastating to so many. The first day, I told people before the storm hit that when they got out, the first thing they should do is take initiative, because our streets would have logs. Every street was clogged by logs. It was the city on 2 weeks ago Saturday was totally impassable. That everybody had a saw, a chainsaw, or an axe ought to get out. First, they ought to clear their driveway. Second, clear their street. And then clear the driveway of their neighbors. And I didn't know how many people had chainsaws. If you tell people what they are expected to do, we challenge them. I've driven a Prius for years. All our city new vehicles and the passengers of Priuses. And I told you by the amount by which we cut our energy consumption. There's a role of government as leader, but there are also something to inspire individuals. If each one of us consumes less and designs our houses and our consumption patterns so that we don't need new power generation, and we killed some coal-fired plants and fought them, if we, each of us, does our part, then we all benefit. Because who do you think pays for that large-scale power plants? And as we get the grid back up in the wake of these storms, let this be a reminder of the benefits of some of the distributed power generation. And, Senor President, you don't need to have, photovoltaics apply to all your household power needs, but I'll tell you what, it sure would be nice to have a panel up there that has a direct link to one light in your refrigerator. And if we start thinking about that, house by house, building by building, we can do some dramatic things. And I think the old trade-off between the short run and the long run, between the feel-good, politically correct project where there's no analysis of the cost and benefits and the things that have real practical benefits that people can feel, now is the time to act, and acting locally is sometimes the very best.
Thank you so much, Mayor White. Let me turn now to Sherry Liao. First of all, Sherry, congratulations on your being awarded the CGI Global Citizen Award last night. You were fabulous. Now, back in 1996, Sherry founded the Global Village of Beijing, which is today one of the leading NGOs in China working on issues of environment and sustainability. She is the leader of what was called the 26-degree campaign, which meant that air conditioners should be brought to only a low of 26 degrees in China, which was later adopted by the Chinese government as, I guess we would call it, an encouragement for everybody in China to follow, as a norm. I was thinking here over the last 2 days that the first thing we should have and arrange is a meeting after this session between Sherry and the management of this hotel. But then let's see a show of hands out there in the audience. How many of you work or live in air-conditioned environments? Okay. How many of you that raise your hand are willing to go back after this and apply that rule that Sherry has gotten in China in your own home and your office environment? Great, super. That's what change is all about. That's what Mayor White has just convened us to do in terms of becoming real agents of change and going out there and contributing with something very factual that we can all help mitigate climate change. So back to you, Sherry, and your work now in the Sichuan province. You know, one gets the impression when you speak to Chinese leadership up at the top that they are very much aware of what the environment poses as both a threat, if it's not addressed, and an opportunity for Chinese development. Tell us what's happening at the ground root, at the ground level, at the grassroots level, and please address, if you're so kind to, the issue of how you interact with authorities at the local level in China so that they don't see you as an opponent and rather they see you as an ally in something that has to be done.
Thank you. Thank you again. I really appreciate the award from President Clinton. Actually, I met him in 1998 when he organized a roundtable meeting about the environment. He didn't invite, you know, our administrator of environment protection, but he invited the 7 citizens to attend the roundtable meeting. And I tell him that time, our mission is to tell Chinese people don't follow or don't copy the mistake you made, such as too many air conditioning, too many private car, and too many one-time use products. Unfortunately, a lot of Chinese people are following. So our work is to still to try to persuade people to choose more natural, more environmental lifestyle, like air conditioning, energy saving action. And I used to be research of China Academy of Social Science and used to be a teacher of a university for philosophy with my master philosophy degree. And it was in United States, actually in New York. I met a lot of NGO people, 1992, a lot of NGO people, not only from US, but also from some developing country like Kenya, India. I realized how important role that NGO to play for environmental protection. Then I saw my country, so huge country, but so few NGO that I decided go back to China 1995 to establish Global Village of Beijing. And 2000, we mobilized that time 20 NGOs together for Earth Day activities. And then every year, so we organize NGO networking conference. And in 2002, we organized NGO grassroots delegation to go to Johannesburg for WSSD. And then after that, we organize NGO campaign almost every year. My organization worked together with other like 15 NGOs to initiate a series of environmental campaign, including air conditioning. And also, there are some very successful story about plastic bag limitation. Yeah, when we appeal the less use plastic bag, and eventually government take a kind of a policy to charge the fee for plastic bag last year. Mm-hmm. And also, after my NGO appeal, the Carefree Day, like I think 2 years, government organized a Carefree Day activities mm-hmm. in 108 cities. The mayors make commitment to do Carefree Day activities. So there are a lot of very good story how NGO can work together, can influence policymaker to change the huge country for sustainability. So I think another way I would like to mention is how NGO can work together with the media to influence policymaker. And we, since 2003, we organized we called Journalist Forum on Sustainable Energy. Every year, there is a 7 forum on sustainable energy, plus 1 award to journalists who make huge contribution to the sustainable energy. We got 3 times very positive comment from our Deputy Prime Minister about green building, public transportation, anyway, sustainable energy policy. This is another way that NGO can influence policy, can work together with government through providing the training program for journalists. And the third way that NGO can work together, like you mentioned, we work together for some specific pilot project, like Green Community Pilot Project in 1999. We worked together with Xuanwu District Government to establish first pilot project of a green community with what we call software, means public participation mechanism, and hardware, means environmental facility and in the community. And the mayor of Beijing organized 100 governors to visit our pilot project. Then green community, we promote become countrywide policy. And this time, what we are doing to make green village work together with the local government, we hope this kind of pilot project will become national policy very soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Shirley. So let us now go to our last discussion leader, Robert Kennedy. After we hear from Robert, we're going to be asking you for your questions, which we'll be collecting at the back and which we already have of some up front, I believe. Robert is the author of Crimes Against Nature, a fantastic book that went on to become a New York Times bestseller, and which, together with David's book, I recommend his reading. He's traveled the world, Robert. You've traveled the world looking at what can be done at the grassroots level. And I recall having a first meeting with you about 15 years ago in Costa Rica when you were very much into strengthening the Rivers Keepers Network. What lessons have you seen from all of those experiences that you have led and witnessed that can now be transferred as grassroots, shall we say, best-in-class experiences to the issue of mitigating climate change?
Thank you, President Figueres. First, if I could start out by introducing my wife, Mary Richardson, if you could just wave. And Mary is a green architect, and she's just She's involved now in making a 26-part television series with Bob Vila as her co-host on how to build a green house. So if any of you have green products that you want showcased in her film, there she is. I wanted to do that because we're going to be going home to an unair-conditioned house, apparently, and I want to keep everybody in a good mood.
Sorry about that.
But I run the Waterkeeper Alliance, which is the umbrella group for now 190 waterkeepers around the country, mainly in North America, but we have 17. We're the largest water protection group in the world. We have 17 in Australia. We have 7 in China. We have 5 in Russia. We have them all over Latin America and Costa Rica, where I met President Figueres for the first time. All of those groups are, each one has a patrol boat, they have a full-time river keeper, and they sue polluters, they prosecute polluters. Well, under existing environmental laws, we have very good environmental laws in our country and many other countries. The problem is they're not enforced. The laws, incidentally, are designed to make free market capitalism work, because when you steal the commons or privatize the commons, you're cheating for the free market. You're creating subsidies for yourself, and so the marketplace doesn't work. People ask me, what's the best solution to our environmental problems? And I say it's free market capitalism, because in a true free market, a free market promotes efficiency, and efficiency means the elimination of waste, and pollution is waste. And a true free market would allow us to properly value our natural resources, and it is the undervaluation of those resources that causes us to use them wastefully. But in a true free market, you can't make yourself rich without making your neighbors rich and without enriching your community. What polluters do is they make themselves rich by making everybody else poor. They raise standards of living for themselves by lowering quality of life for everybody else. And they do that by escaping the discipline of the free market. You show me a polluter, I'll show you a subsidy. I'll show you a fat cat using political clout to escape the discipline of the free market and force the public to pay his production costs. You know, Terry Tamminen's just done this wonderful book called Lives Per Gallon, where he actually inventories the costs of oil. We in this country give our oil industry $1.3 trillion a year in subsidies. And that doesn't even include the Iraq war, which is going to cost us $4.5 trillion, which should be billed to their account. And we give about almost $1 trillion to coal. There's no such thing as clean, cheap coal. This is what they say to us. But, you know, we get 4 cents a kilowatt coal, but it's not really costing us 4 cents a kilowatt. That's what the riverkeepers do. We sue them to force them to internalize their costs. And all of the federal environmental laws are intended to restore free market capitalism in this country by forcing actors to, in the marketplace, to pay the true cost of bringing their product to market. And what we do, we don't even consider ourselves environmentalists anymore. We're free marketeers. We go out into the marketplace, we catch the cheaters, the polluters, and we say to them, we're going to force you to internalize your costs the same way that you're internalizing your profits. Because as long as people are cheating the free market, it distorts the whole marketplace, and none of us gets the advantages of the efficiency, the prosperity, and the democracy that the marketplace otherwise promises our country. And what we have to understand in all of our nations is that there's a huge difference between free market capitalism, which makes a nation more efficient, more prosperous, and more democratic, and the kind of corporate crony capitalism that we have in this country today, which is antithetical to efficiency, prosperity, and democracy in America as it is in Nigeria. And you know what? We need, if I'm doing a lot of, something really great that I'm doing now is a lot of entrepreneurial stuff. I'm on the board of the biggest green tech firm in the country, and it's got Vantage Point Venture Capital. It's got 53% returns. It has 30 companies that are like the Googles of the future. One of these companies you might have heard of, which is called Better Place, Shai Agassi's company. We are rewiring Israel today. Within 3 years, Israel's going to be off gasoline cars. We've got joint ventures with Renault and Nissan. They're going to build the platform cars. We're producing millions of batteries. You're going to be able to drive into any gas station in Israel, slide out your exhausted battery, slide in a fresh one. It takes less than 30 seconds. Now we have a huge reservoirs of batteries that we're going to be able to use to store wind and solar energy, and we're building huge wind and solar arrays across the Negev Desert. And Israel is going to slap a 75%. When we're done in 3 years rewiring the country, they'll slap a 75% tax on gasoline vehicles and raise it every year till they're taxed out of existence. And Israel just said, we're going to be off of oil in 3 years. And this is what we're doing. We have contracted to Denmark next. Then we're going to do the UK. We have 30 countries lined up to get contracts to do the same thing. It's not going to take us 10 years. It's going to take us 3 years. You look at all that we just sold one of our other companies, BrightSource, just signed a $9 billion contract to provide solar thermal energy to California, a gigawatt a year. And we're building that plant cheaper than you can build any nuke plant, any coal plant, or any gas plant. This is cheaper. The only way that those carbon incumbents, can compete with us in a marketplace is with their subsidies. And what we've done for years is sue them to get rid of those subsidies. But if we get rid of their subsidies, you know, you look at the nations that have decarbonized their economy. In every case, they've experienced instantaneous prosperity. Iceland in 1970 was the poorest country in Europe. It was 100% dependent on imported coal and oil. It decided to decarbonize its society because the Iceland government was one of the first to experience directly the impacts of global warming, which hurt the northern latitudes disproportionately. People said vested interests said, we can't do this quickly. We have to do it incrementally. Iceland went ahead and did it. Today, Iceland is 100% energy independent. It gets 90% of its electric power from geothermal. And today, Iceland is the fourth richest country by GDP on the face of the earth. It is one of the world's largest energy exporters. It can't run lines across the Atlantic, but it imports bauxite from Jamaica, uses its surplus to smelt the bauxite into aluminum, and sells the ingots abroad, and that's its way of exporting energy. Sweden in 1996 said it was going to decarbonize its society. It slapped $150 a ton a tax on carbon. It closed its two biggest nuclear power plants. Today, Sweden is the sixth richest country by GDP in the world. One of the reasons that Costa Rica is now the wealthiest country in Central America is because President Figueres helped decarbonize the power system in that country. Brazil, where these gentlemen are from, decarbonized its transportation system, and as a result of that, it is experiencing the largest, the most vigorous, the most robust, and the longest economic boom in its history. So this isn't going to cost us money. It's going to save us money, and a lot of people are going to get rich. The only people who are standing in the way are the carbon cronies who are committing treason against our country. Every single day, we're spending borrowing $1 billion a day from people who don't like us to buy oil from people who don't like us. And that's what's caused the collapse of the American dollars. They're talking about $700 billion on Capitol Hill. Well, $700 billion is trivial. We spend that every year on oil in this country. If we got rid of that, we'd have no problems paying the bills. I'll shut up. Woo!
Robert, thank you very much. I know for a fact that your statistics in Costa Rica are correct. I'm sure your statistics in Iceland are correct. I hope so, because we have in the room the president of Iceland with us, President Grimson. And I'd just like to recognize him for a minute, if I may. Thank you, sir. A good reality check, huh? Good reality check on the panel. Okay, we have some questions, and I'm going to go to you with your questions to the panelists. We're beginning to be close to the ending of the session, and we want to be on time here. So I'm going to ask our panelists to take a few seconds to reflect on the question and come back with an answer that is about 45 seconds so that we can get a lot of questions answered. They may be a little longer, but let's make an effort. Mayor Delano, let's start with you, please. Would you consider a congestion pricing for Paris? Why or why not? A congestion pricing. Is that correct pronunciation in English, congestion? Thank you.
Non,
Non, pour le moment, on a pu
no, for the time being, in 5 years, we dropped the pollution 32%, and instead of 5%, just by changing, changing the mode of transport without putting any kind of tolls at the entrance of Paris. Something is a little linked to our situation. That is that if we charge something from the people who live outside, if we do, I think we will have a psychological and political problem that I would prefer to avoid. So we drop the pollution without taxing.
Thank you, sir. Mayor White, have you considered setting green standards for rebuilding from the hurricane damage?
Well, yes. And I don't think that we want to make it, how would I say it, we don't want to create two classes of citizens. One where we meet one building standard just because a tree happened to fall through your roof, and another that you're building a house. I mean, that sounds like something that a politician would do and put out a press release and call it progress. But we really do believe in equity, that what's good for one person should be good for another. And we will this year have a residential code. Our commercial building code is probably the tightest in the nation. I think Vancouver's ahead of us, and we were able to do that. Residential will be one of the tightest in the nations, and I will tell you this, what we are doing in Houston, Texas, is wherever there's this post-World War II housing that we have, we're retrofitting it block by block for free, free to the citizens. It costs about $950. And where we do that, we've already knocked out 5,000 residential units. We reduce the electricity consumption by 12% annually, 20% at peak. Now, if we do that for everyone, if this country did this for everyone, we wouldn't need any new power generation for a long, long time.
Thank you, sir. Shetty, what strategies have been most successful in your collaboration and cooperation with the central government? What strategies have been most successful in your cooperation with the central government?
I think we help the officials, no matter central government or local government, to get their political achievement, which is environmental protection. So, as I said, we influence policymakers. We work together with government through several ways: public campaign, Journalist forum, as well as some prior project. I would like to say one word. I'm just wondering if we can initiate a really global initiative, which is air conditioning, energy saving action through Clinton Global Initiative. Let's start from specific action. Thank you.
Super. Thank you. Robert, what are the impediments to rewire the U.S. like you're doing in Israel?
The big problem that we have in the U.S. with the marketplace is that we don't have a national grid, that we have an archaic grid that is incapable of transporting the power efficiently. It can't handle the power that we have. So if you're a wind farm owner in Texas, you can't sell your electrons in New York City because the electrons will diffuse before they ever get across the Texas border. So the first big impediment is that we need to rebuild our grid. We need a smart grid that can store power smartly and then deploy it. In order to do that, that's going to cost $500 billion, but we'll get off of oil. It'll cost a ninth the cost of the Iraq war. What we need... The grid is also misaligned so that it doesn't reach West Texas. It doesn't reach we have enough wind power. The Midwest, American Midwest, is the Saudi Arabia of wind. We have enough wind just in Montana, North Dakota, and Texas to power our entire energy, even if every American owned an electric car. But the grid doesn't reach there. We have enough power in 19% of the most barren desert lands in the desert Southwest, an area 92 miles by 92 miles to power all the energy needs in our country from solar. But unfortunately, the grid doesn't reach there. We have enough geothermal to power all of our country. But again, the areas where there's geothermal, we don't have access to the grid, so we need to build out that grid. We need a marketplace, essentially, that where every American can hook up to and sell their energy. And we need what the other impediment is, that in each of the 50 states, we have a different public utilities commission with an arcane and Byzantine web of rules, each of their own, that restrict access to the grid. What we need to do is what, you know, Bill is doing in Houston and what people are doing elsewhere, which is that the next president has to meet with all the governors and say, we're going to get rid of all of these restrictions to the access to the grid, and the grid will have to take energy from anybody who produces it. And the lowest cost producers have to have access to that grid. Do the same thing that we did with the 1996 with the Telecommunications Act, which caused the explosion in telecommunications activity in this country, or we did in 1980 with the ARPANET, where we built a national backbone. In 1980, there were only 500 laptop PCs in this country, and IBM said it's a dead-end technology. Then we built a marketplace, and look what happened. And the price of bits and bytes and information, which was very high then, plummeted, and that's what will happen to electrons when we create a national backbone for our grid. What we need is a marketplace that does what a marketplace is supposed to do, which is to reward good behavior, which is efficiency, and to punish bad behavior, which is inefficiency and waste. Right now, we have a marketplace in our country that is rigged to reward the filthiest, least efficient, most costly producers, and to punish all the rest of us. We need to turn every American into an energy entrepreneur, every home into a power plant, so that if you have photovoltaics on your house and your house is generating more energy during some part of the day than you're using, you ought to be able to sell that to the grid, and you ought to be able to get market rates for it.
Thanks a lot, Robert. Let's hold on there for a minute. Thank you. Major Delannoy, you have a very successful bicycle sharing program in Paris, which has now been copied in D.C., Washington, D.C., amongst other cities. Could you please tell us some facts about this sharing program, what the initial investment was, how many bicycles are rented per day, what the benefits, how do you measure payback? I'm sure you carry all of these facts on a day-to-day basis.
Briefly, to answer, in 1 year, there's been 27 million users of this service. Secondly, the manner in which we did it through market economy, competition between the various companies, brings in the coffers of Paris. But it costs very little for the users, because we coupled it with the advertising. Three, there's always some modifications that have to be done, because it wear and tear, because there's the fashion that will be folded. Now, the vehicle itself is going to be a bit better adapted to its various users. Second evolution, we take it to other the neighboring cities of Paris. In terms of evolution, it also requires a change in attitude on the public part. Of course, 30 years ago, we were all motorists. Today, it's rather a fashion now, and perhaps a charm of the city to see people running around on bicycles. The Vélib is the name we give it, together with a private enterprise who are the executive who implement the product. We are the biggest sports arena in the world now. And now this will bring a smile. When I'd gone to Paris Plage, the beaches of Paris, yes, but there are people who love each other, people who meet and flirt. And now it appears that on Internet there are networks of meetings via Vélib, which is bicycle free, and even marriages which started with Vélib. And that, I like that very much.
Mayor White, what are the top policies you championed to help slow growth in energy demand?
I'll give you 30 seconds. I just say to my colleague, Mayor Paris, I'm a bicyclist. I bicycle to work some, and bicycle sales are booming in Houston, Texas. And after $4 a gallon, boy, I'll tell you what, some people are taking a look at bicycling to work that never thought so before. But some of our basic policies, Jose, we want to, are tough building standards. And then setting a lead in city government at what we can do with vehicles. Now, this goes beyond local government, but I worked on the first bill back in 1975, helped write parts of it that set CAFE standards. Congress has taken a step in the right direction, but needs to go out farther. There's no city in the world that a few years from now should have garbage trucks running on standard diesel engines. We all ought to have hybrids, and we've already begun to deploy them and replace the conventional bus fleet we have with hybrids, which we will be doing buying all hybrids for our mass transportation fleet. And then there's more. We are deploying 250,000 of real-time meters in the residences and businesses in our community, and we want everybody to have a meter that would allow them to do exactly what Bobby said, that if you have a rooftop photovoltaic going to a battery, and it normally trips into your refrigerator, then you can discharge that battery at the 30 minutes a day into the grid that's the peak. And I'll tell you, by doing that, our electrical power system will be much more efficient, because the last power plant you need to meet that peak load is by far and away the most expensive.
Thank you, sir. Shetty, what actions are being taken by the Chinese government to educate citizens and encourage them to become more energy efficient?
Government?
Yes.
Government have a kind of a policy, countrywide policy, which is a 20% energy saving before 2020. And they have a serious regulation on private sector and the community. But what we are doing is to initiate a countrywide campaign called 20% Energy Saving Action, then cooperate with 50 environmental NGOs to promote that. So we have a kind of a very simple education material that also provided to government and people. Say this site is a 12 disaster caused by climate change, and this site is 12 action that individual can do in their daily life. Anyway, according to Chinese traditional philosophy, the environment protection is very simple, just follow up the nature. For example, never make summer like winter, winter like summer. Very simple. Okay. Thank you.
Robert, why do free market advocates support huge subsidies for coal and oil, but consistently vote against the solar and wind tax credits?
These are people who say that they're free market advocates, but they're really not free market advocates. If you look at these, you know, these think tanks on Capitol Hill, like the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, the Cato Institute, all of these that are supposedly free market think tanks, they have nothing to do. They hate free market capitalism. If you look at their feet, rather than listening to the seductive noises that issue from their lips, what they really want is corporate domination. They want, they want capitalism for the poor, like a very ruthless, savage kind of capitalism for the poor, but at the same time, a socialism for the rich, the kind that's being debated in Washington, D.C. today. You know, and so they don't really like marketplaces, and they want a laissez-faire capitalism where people can come and steal the water, the air. You know, the Southern Company, it's a coal utility, puts coal up in its stacks, and there's mercury in it. It falls on New York State, and it poisons our children's brains. And it has ozone and particulates that cause 60,000 deaths in this country every year, 1 million asthma attacks, 1 million lost work days. They've poisoned the lakes of the Adirondacks, of the Appalachians. Forest cover has been destroyed from on the high peaks from Georgia all the way up into northern Quebec. We're cutting down the Appalachian Mountains. All of these impacts impose costs on the rest of us that should, in a true free market capitalism, be reflected in the price of that company's product when it makes it to market. But that's not what they want. They want that these companies to come in and be able to manufacture subsidies for themselves by stealing the commons, by stealing the publicly owned wealth. Mary and I have three sons who have asthma. And, you know, they've literally stolen, they've privatized the air in my children's lungs because my kids can't breathe it anymore safely. And they privatized every fish in New York State. I get a fishing license every year in this state for $30. But we can't eat the fish anymore because all of them have mercury from these coal-burning power plants. And that's a cost of coal that's not reflected in your coal bill, but it's a cost that all of us are paying. And it's a phony kind of, you know, they could talk about free markets. They don't like free markets at all. They like corporate crony capitalism.
Thanks a lot, Robert. So we're coming to the end of our session here. But I'd like to ask you to hold your seats here just for 2 minutes. First of all, I'd like to invite you to please join me in thanking Mayor Delannoy, Robert, Shetty, and Mayor White for their appearances here with us this morning and sharing their experiences. Thank you very much. Really, thank you. Thank you all also for your participation and for your questions. We all come to CGI with different perspectives and with different things that we want to get out of it and that we want to contribute to CGI. For me, CGI is my personal sustainable battery recharger. You know, the world's a pretty rough place out there, especially if you're working on sustainability issues like all of us here are doing, and we're trying to push the limits of the envelope every day. And you get bruised and knocked up as you're going out there, and coming back to CGI, participating in this great set of sessions with discussion leaders and actors that are really doing things in their communities, as we've had this morning, kind of recharges our batteries and gets us ready to go back out there, do battle for another year before we come in for another recharging station to the next CGI. Now, there's some people that are critical in putting this recharging station together and in making all of this happen. And this being the last session that we have before the plenaries, I would like to ask them to come up here and all of us to give them a big round of applause. I'm talking about David Sandalow. Come on up, David. But I'm also talking about Amy Christensen, who does such a terrific job, with P.J. Simmons. Where are you, P.J.? Come on up here. David Spielfogel and Rachel Transtein. Rachel? Great. Thank you. They do a great job. Thanks a lot. Here we go. One big hand.
Thank you.
And one big hand for yourselves. Thank you ever so much. God bless.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Our workshop is completed. A luncheon buffet will be served in the second and third floor foyers. A special session, Overcoming Poverty in Challenging Environments, will be in New York East and New York West at 12.